Hello, Kate Lamb here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, sneaking supplies across borders in Myanmar, a dramatic and tragic protest at the Indonesian State Palace, and Afghanistan's first all-women's orchestra. Welcome to Asia Calling, and thanks for tuning into the show. This week, Asia's youngest democracy, Timor-Leste, or East Timor, held its first presidential election since the UN peacekeeping mission left the country in 2012. It's just the fourth presidential election since the country gained independence from neighbouring Indonesia. As Teodosia Dos Reis reports from the capital, Dili, democracy is well on track in the small, half-island nation.
Eight candidate contests the election this past week, including six independent candidates and two from political party, the Democratic Party, PD, and the historic Fretilin Party, of Timor's population of 1.2 million. 740,000 eligible to vote. It's been a busy election season. Leading the polls is the former revolutionary leader, Francisco Guterres Duolo. He has run twice for president, both times unsuccessful. But this year, it looks different. Guterres, backed by the Fretilin Party and the CNRT, the party founded by independence hero Xanana Gusmão, who has provided key support to Guterres during his election campaign. Guterres says, since his day in the jungle fighting for independence, he has never stopped fighting for his dream.
Depois de funo naro que dané, halutei roto e tahu de belas sai independente.
Fight, liberate the nation. I have a long story that goes back 24 years, from fighting in the jungle for independence from the Indonesian occupation of Timor-Leste. Finally, we became independent in 1999. Now I want to help bring the country out of poverty. This has been a dream long in the making.
Timor-Leste remains one of the world's poorest countries, with about 40% of its population categorized as poor. The country is heavily reliant on oil revenues. But analysts say money is fast drying up. Back at the polls, a team of 35 election observers from the European Union Election Observation Mission are also here to oversee the vote at the 10 of 13 municipalities across the country. Chief Observer Izaskun Bilibaun Barandika commended the vote, saying that it had been smooth and peaceful nationwide.
Realmente, las evaluaciones que nos han enviado son mayoritariamente muy buenas.
The Timorese people, the electoral authorities, candidates, and civil society organizations all contributed to Monday's peaceful presidential elections, in which the right to universal, free, and equal suffrage was respected in line with Timor-Leste's constitution.
No hemos detectado ningún problema que podamos destacar.
Barandika also said the election procedures were transparent.
Durante la votación se siguieron también los procedimientos de transparencia.
From the registration of voters and candidates to voting, counting, and the tabulations of results, procedures were followed in a transparent manner and with sufficient guarantees, and also has equal gender balance of polling station members.
Camilo Almeida, a lector from National University Timor-Leste, UNTL, says Timor-Leste's democracy is well on track.
Even though the political issues sometimes focus on the conflict, the Timorese people are not affected. They can see through the politics. People know about the democratic system, and until now, the situation is safe.
With all ballots counted after Monday's election, the results are in. Securing 57% of the vote, Luolo Guterres looks certain to be the next president. Guterres will be the first presidential candidate to have won a clear majority in the first round since Xanana Guzmán was overwhelmingly elected president in 2002. The result is expected to be confirmed on April 2. For Asia Calling, this is Teodosia Dos Reis from Dili, Timor Leste.
For nearly 2 weeks, more than 50 farmers have staged a dramatic protest in the Indonesian capital. They've bound their feet in boxes of concrete in front of the presidential palace and vowed not to leave until the president comes to meet them and agrees to stop a new cement factory from opening in their community. From Jakarta, Nicole Kirby has this story.
Rough, swollen toes peek out from boxes. But the rest of the foot is hidden, encased in a block of hardened grey cement. The feet belong to a Javanese farmer by the name of Gunretno, who is sitting here kind of stoically grimacing.
Yeah, sebenarnya sakit, sakit, tapi kami,
it is very painful, but the pain, we are ready to take the pain because it is not only for us, but it is for the sake of our future generation and all the people, especially farmers in Kendeng Lestari. So we fight not only for our sake, but for everyone's sake and the environmental sake.
With their feet in heavy blocks, everyday movements are impossible. It takes three people to move one farmer at a time. But Gunretno doesn't care. He travelled 12 hours to sit here, in the searing sun and beating rain, in front of the presidential palace, to make a point. Along with 50 other farmers, he stayed there for over a week.
Kami juga sakit sih dicor kaki seperti ini.
It is hurt. It feels being filled with concrete with our foot we cannot move. But we think that it is the best way to complain to Mr. Jokowi.
Mr. Jokowi, or Joko Widodo, that's the Indonesian president. Gunretno and the farmers hope to implore him to stop a cement factory from going ahead on their farming land. In the meantime, they've sent him this letter.
Pak Presiden tampil kembali sebagai pemimpin rakyat dan menghentikan.
The farmers from Rembang in central Java believe that a cement factory will pollute, dry up and ultimately destroy their water sources, effectively ending their lives as farmers. Rembang farmer Sakina explains.
Kami adalah bagian dari warga desa.
We are the residents of the villages in the vast landscape of Kendeng who will lose our livelihoods as farmers if PT Cement Factory and cement mining goes ahead in Rembang.
This fight against the country's largest cement company, PT Cement, has been going on for more than a decade. For the past 2 years, the farmers of Rembang have protested outside the factory site in an attempt to stop construction. They say they face violence and intimidation from police and company workers there.
Since 2012,
they have been toying with us as citizens and farmers. They play hide and seek with tactics that breaks the rule of law, ignoring our opinion and continuing to invest in the cement industry.
Last October, the Supreme Court ruled that construction of the factory must be halted until an environmental impact assessment was completed. But building has continued illegally. Then, this February, local governor Ganjar Pranowo contradicted the ruling, issuing permits allowing construction to go ahead. Matthew Michel Lengu from Community Legal Aid Jakarta explains.
What we saw the local government is they don't want to follow the Supreme Court ruling and they not respect the court itself by issuing the new licenses to the company. What we want now is we want the government to do some actions, giving the pressures to the local government to revoke the licenses and then follow the Supreme Court ruling.
The mountainous region of Rembang is home to over 500,000 people, and not all of them oppose the cement factory. Some believe it will create several thousand jobs in their community. But in an area known as Lumbang Padi di Indonesia, or the rice bowl of Indonesia, there's a lot to lose, says farmer Gunretno.
jelas sekali. Jadi Indonesia sebagai negara agraris,
knowing that Indonesia is agricultural country, Indonesia has already so many concrete factory, and this concrete factory has taken the land of the farmers. If all the land of the farmers is sacrificed for the sake of concrete factory, of course the food production will be affected.
Lahan-lahan pertanian hilang untuk penambangan.
The Rembang farmers are resolute, but after a week, the protest is taking a toll, including a fatal one. After sitting with her feet in concrete for 7 days, Ibu Patmi, 48, one of the farmers, died of a heart attack last Tuesday. Following her death, the farmers have finally taken the cement off their feet and headed home to Rembang. But it's not over. And after more than a week, the president's office has announced that it will delay opening the factory and suspend cement mining in the area. But the farmers of Rembang aren't planning on giving up until the factory is scrapped altogether. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Jakarta.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. Since the Myanmar government blocked humanitarian aid, much-needed food and medical supplies from entering parts of the northern state of Kachin last year, the situation has grown desperate. There are more than 100,000 people living in refugee camps and food rations have now been halved. Asia Calling correspondent Kanika Pet Kao recently travelled in secret to the area controlled by the Kachin Independence Army, or the KIA, to find out how humanitarian workers are responding to the situation and, in some cases, manoeuvring around the blockade.
Toilar is in his mid-20s. He's friendly, cheerful, hardly ever without his broad smile. He works with traumatized youth in refugee camps here, engaging them through art, music, and drama. But when he has time, he likes to ride his motorbike around Kachin. Riding, he says, has long been a part of his life. In Kachin, the civil war has been running on and off since the early 1960s. A ceasefire agreement between the government and the KIA, which has long pushed for independence, fell apart in 2011. Toilar had just finished high school at the time. When the conflict started, Toilar jumped on his motorbike and rode for days on end. Hundreds of thousands of people were fleeing, but the KIA-controlled area was blocked, on one side by the army, on the other, the Chinese border. Thousands of Kachin were trapped. As Toilar watched the situation unfold, he made his way to the jungle and helped the only way he knew how, picking up people on the back of his bike and taking them one by one to safer ground. Like Toilar on his motorbike, Bokkun has just driven his four-wheel drive car down from the mound. He's helping to move internally displaced people, or IDPs, away from the fighting, taking them out of harm's way. 6 years after the fighting broke out, more than 120,000 of people in Kachin have been displaced.
These IDPs also, like, they are feeling like stress and they feel so tired. After 5-6 years, they have to flee many times again and again.
Bokkun is from an NGO called the Kachin Development Group, one of only 9 groups allowed to work in the KIA-controlled area. Since early last year, the government asked international agencies not to deliver humanitarian assistance, food and medical supplies into the area, citing safety and security concerns. When the World Food Programme sent trucks into the area on September 9th last year, they were turned back.
UN agencies cannot come directly or routinely, let's say. But in the government control area, they can access whenever they want because they have MOU with government and government don't allow them to come this KIO control area.
Moving IDPs out of the intensive fighting area means Bokun has to risk his own life. But there's little choice. The situation has deteriorated so much after the government blocked it, he says. There are few people around to do the job. For Bokun, it feels like an uphill battle.
Sometimes, myself, I feel like the big organizations and NGOs or UN agencies, they are they don't care what normal people's happening because they have good relation with government, so they can work and stay peacefully, and what they want to do, they can do.
There are thousands of displaced people to care for and dwindling resources. IDPs in Kachin now live on less than 20 cents a day, while rations of rice and milk have been halved. Bokun and other local NGOs are also under heavy scrutiny from the army, which is working to ensure supply lines stay blocked. In recent months, the Myanmar army has intensified their offensive with heavy shelling and airstrike. Some also wonder if the blockers of supplies are being used as a weapon of war too.
It's always hard to know what's going to happen. I can think even what's happened so far over the last few years, I would never have predicted could happen. I would never have thought that they would have had a reasonably...
Doug Gibbons works for an international NGO called Partners. Even after years of working in the area, his agency is one of those impacted by the blockade.
Very difficult to get in there, and then very difficult to get them to come out. So, that's ongoing for us. We'd love to do more development work there, because we've been working there for a little while, but haven't really been able to do...
While big humanitarian agencies have abided by the government's order, other international agencies have found a way to continue to help. During my trip, I heard stories of how some are sneaking assistance to the KA areas, such as delivering food and medical supplies in secret, even though it comes with great risk. For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petgal in Kachin State, Myanmar.
Afghanistan has a rich musical culture, but it's not an easy world for women to break into. 18-year-old Nijen Kalpawak knows that struggle all too well. In the face of hostility and threats, even from her family, Nijen has battled to follow her musical passions. Gayo Waziri has her story. At the Afghan National Institute of Music in Kabul, dozens of young women are practicing their musical instruments. The sounds of the violin, piano, trumpet and rubab, a lute-like instrument from central Afghanistan, fill the room. It's not easy for women to be accepted here, says 18-year-old Negin Apulwak.
The only reason I came to Kabul was social conservatism, which stops girls from going to school in Kunar. My father decided to bring me to Kabul so I could finish school. I never thought once, even in my dreams, that I will be able to play music here. But now I'm leading the orchestra and playing piano, and I really enjoy it.
From a big family in the remote province of Kunar in eastern Afghanistan, none of Nagin's family supported her love of music. And she's not from a wealthy family either, so in Kabul she lives in an orphanage. Apart from her father, everyone in Nagin's family was against her studying music.
When I passed the exam for the music institute, they phoned my mother to tell her, but she was really angry about it. So I had to tell her there was a misunderstanding, that I have been accepted into a private school, not a music school.
During Taliban rule, playing musical instruments was banned, and today conservative Muslims still frown upon many forms of music. In Kunar, girls usually finish school after about 5 years, and most find themselves in arranged marriages from a very young age. But with the help of her father, Nagin battled hard against that. For years, she practiced her music in secret.
My father faced a lot of pressure from the family, from my uncles, to stop me from studying music. At times, he had to leave the house and come to Kabul, but he never stopped me from learning. He also really likes music, and I am so thankful to him.
After years of practice and study, Nagin now leads Afghanistan's first women's orchestra. It's an ensemble of 35 women musicians, which plays both traditional and Western music. Her teacher, Fareed Shifter, explains why Nagin was chosen as the lead.
She was one of our most active and talented students. Because of her knowledge and talent, we decided to promote her and make her the first leader of the Afghan Women's Orchestra. One of her best and strong productions that she led recently was the Children's National Anthem, which will be played in all Afghan schools.
The children's anthem is about promoting education to Afghan children. Fekri Aziz, a student of Nagin's at the Music Institute, says she is impressed by Nagin's leadership.
Nijan is mostly relaxed and calm when she's supporting or conducting us, so I like working with her. We hope in the future we can have more women orchestra leaders.
Nagin says she's happy that she's had the chance to show off the abilities of Afghanistan and also of Afghan women abroad.
One of the most wonderful memories for me was when our team went to Dubai, Turkmenistan and other countries and performed. Everyone was marveling about how Afghanistan has this kind of orchestra, a men and women's mixed team, while the society is conservative and there is warfare.
But there's still plenty of goals on her list.
I want to continue my work as an orchestra leader and player, and even receive my doctoral degree in this field. Through this job, I want to serve Afghanistan and form the country's first national orchestra, just as other countries have.
In a country known for the restrictions it places on women, Nagin's story shows that there are other possibilities. For Asia Calling, this report was compiled by Gayo Waziri in Kabul, Afghanistan. That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling. You can now also podcast the show, go to the iTunes store and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to our weekly episodes. I'm Kate Lamb, back next week with more stories from Asia.
হাতের কাছের তারাগুলো দেখায় কেন।